The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
How much can you tell about a person's character and personality from their handwriting? Dr. Mark Seifer, a handwriting analysis expert and a fascinating author on a variety of subjects, joins us today to answer this question. I'm Julie Hartman, and this is Timeless. And welcome to the show where I talk about timeless, eternal subjects. Just to remind you, you can follow me on Instagram and Twitter at Julie R. Hartman. Please like, comment, and subscribe to this page. And also, if you would like to see the news segment of this show, check out the Julie Noted playlist on this YouTube channel. I am thrilled today that Dr. Mark Seifer, is joining us. He is an author and retired professor at Roger Williams University. He is the preeminent authority on the life of Nikola Tesla, who is the Serbian-American inventor who discovered the rotating magnetic field, the basis of most alternating current machinery that has made technologies such as our cell phone and TV possible. Dr. Seifer has also published books about subjects ranging from ozone therapy to the mind and consciousness to science fiction. He is also, as I said in the introduction, an expert on handwriting analysis, and he will be analyzing some samples that I have provided to him today. Dr. Seifer, thank you so much for coming on to the show.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I would like to start off, before we go into these handwriting samples and talking about Tesla and ozone therapy and all of the subjects that you are so well-versed in, I'd like to ask you how you came into this career. What's really remarkable reading your biography is that you seem to be a jack-of-all-trades. I mean, just you've published so many books and articles about really a wide variety of subjects. So how did you get to be this way? And how did your interest specifically in these subjects start?
Well, when I graduated college, I read an article about handwriting analysis. And that intrigued me because the idea that you could learn a lot about a person, even if that person was no longer on the planet, just by looking at his handwriting, that really got to me. So the person who wrote the article was Dan Anthony. He was the grandnephew of Susan B. Anthony, and he was teaching at the New School for Social Research in New York City. So since I grew up in New York, I went back home, lived with my parents for about 2 years, and began to study graphology with Dan Anthony. I took 5 courses there, and then I got into graduate school at the University of Chicago, and I continued to study handwriting, all phases of handwriting. I was studying schizophrenic people, as compared to normal people, and how mental illness might affect handwriting, how brain damage could affect handwriting. And then when I returned to Rhode Island, where I graduated from college, I began to work for the crime laboratory as a handwriting expert. But when I was in Chicago, I also was working on a master's degree. And my master's degree, since I was a psych major, was on the unconscious before Freud, and in advance of Freud. Sigmund Freud basically says we're basically unconscious beings. We think we're conscious, but we're really unconscious. And a lot of the forces that rule us are unconscious. But I then started to study Carl Jung, and he talked about the collective unconscious, where all humans kind of share the same feelings. And that extends to other animals. I love, for instance, the show Nature. And you look at the mama bear holding the baby bear. That feeling, we have the same feeling. I mean, all animals share a lot of that thing, and that's part of what the collective unconscious is. And then I read another book, which had to do with life after death and telepathy, and that all minds were interlinked. And that got me into parapsychology. So I wrote my master's degree was on levels of mind, which was the unconscious beyond Freud. And I started to study ESP. And I was amazed to find out that J.B. Ryan was doing studies. He was still alive down at Duke University. And I went down to Duke to meet with the group there. I didn't end up meeting him, but I met some of the people there. And they were doing astral projection, life after death studies, telepathy, even psychokinesis. Could you, you know, you roll the dice? Can you influence the fall of the dice? And when I came back to Rhode Island, I hooked up with a fellow who was teaching a course on UFOs. And he went down to New York. His name was Howard Smuckler. And he became the editor of ESP magazine and also Ancient Astronauts magazine. And so I began writing articles for all these different magazines and, you know, still teaching. And that's how we ended up hooking up with Uri Geller, who was the psychic. He's still on the planet. He's in Israel. And Uri Geller was working with, you know, the CIA. He didn't know it was the CIA. He just thought it was Stanford Research Institute. But they were doing studies. He had telepathic abilities and psychokinetic abilities. He could bend metal with his mind and do all these incredible things. So I was teaching normal psychology, but also teaching parapsychology. And one day when I went down to New York to write an article about a Tibetan Lama, I found an article about a man who invented fluorescent and neon lighting, remote control, the hydroelectric power system. You mentioned the rotating magnetic field, what became cell phone technology, wireless communication. And his name was Tesla. And I said, you know, I'm living in a crazy world to begin with, but this is really nuts, because it said that he was born on the planet Venus and he came to our planet to help with all these inventions. But I was in the New York Public Library and there his name was. I found an article from about 1905 on high frequency phenomena. And so when I got a book of his patents, I said, boy, I'm on a big story here, because he really has patents for all this thing. This guy really lived. So I wrote my doctoral dissertation as to why his name disappeared from the history books. So that's kind of how I, you know, so I stayed in graphology. I was working for the crime lab doing forgery cases. So I was kind of working in two different directions. You know, with one other thing that you mentioned, you know, my crazy life, I was also interested in palm reading. And I was kind of torn, because I wanted to go into movies. I wanted to teach psychology. And I looked at my palm and I had two fate lines. I don't know if you can see, but there are two lines going up here and here. So you have these two lines, and it says someone has two lines should have two different careers. And it like solved something for me, because I thought I had to be one thing. And here, you know, a palm reading book says, no, you can be two things. So I studied, you know, psychology, and I studied also graphology, and I studied more than two things. And I studied filmmaking at the same time. And I just felt relieved that there was something in my nature that led me in that direction.
I love meeting people like you. I mean, it's so, so interesting, all of your interests and what you've done with your career. Forgive me, would you mind putting your hand back up again? I have a question. So you said there are two fate lines. Are they I think I see four lines here. Do you mean the two in the middle that intersect are your two fate lines?
No, going around the thumb is the lifeline. Everybody has a lifeline. And then after that is a line going up.
Oh, I
and
see.
And I have two of them rising up next to the lifeline.
Oh, I
Those
see.
Those are two fate lines. And I, you know, I look at different people's handwritings. For instance, Barack Obama's got a very powerful, strong, one powerful fate line. So if you didn't know who he was and you were a palm reader, you simply look at the guy's palm and say, you have a powerful direction in your life. And so, you know, I was doing that on the side too.
Well, for the next show, I'm going to send you, if you don't mind, some pictures of not only my palm, but some people I know's palms, and we can do some palm reading. But I did send Dr. Cipher some handwriting samples. He does not know who these people are, no background at all, so we're going to get to that very soon. But before we do, can you please tell me a bit more about the history of graphology, which I have since discovered with becoming acquainted with your work means handwriting analysis. When and how did it become a discipline, and how is someone like you trained in analyzing handwriting?
Yeah, graphology was only taught at one college that I knew of, and that was the New School in New York. I took 5 different courses. I also, Dan Anthony was brilliant, and we had to read Alexander Luria. He was kind of the Sigmund Freud of neurophysiology. He was a Russian neurophysiologist. And he looked at people that were brain damaged. In America, you're too young to know, but when President Reagan was the president, he got shot. And Brady was his, one of his spokesperson. Brady dropped down to the ground, and Hinckley got off another shot, hit him in right around here, and the bullet went all the way through and ended in his temporal lobe. When Brady starts to write the B of his last name, he can't stop, so he just keeps looping and looping and looping. So the beginning and ending of goals is in the frontal lobe. So damage to that area tells you, that kind of thing. So here's what's so strange about it. If you saw that in the handwriting, you could guess that he had brain damage in the frontal lobes. So I was studying the neurophysiology of handwriting as well. So you're asking, a very important question. How old is graphology? Most of it started in the late 1800s. Edgar Allan Poe, which was the mid-1800s, was a graphologist. A lot of it is very logical. Someone has a large handwriting is going to be more outgoing. Someone who has small handwriting is probably more shy. Someone who has a rapid handwriting is going to be a quick thinker. Someone with a slow handwriting is more calculating, taking their time. Maybe they're more patient. So you have patience versus impatience, that kind of thing. So it was slowly built up over time. And Gordon Allport was at the Harvard University, and he was a very famous psychologist who also studied graphology and wrote about it. So you had 3 branches. That was psychology. I was also interested in the neurophysiology. How is the brain structured when you write? What's so interesting about that whole thing, when you write, you have a goal. So the goal is in the frontal lobes. The occipital lobe, which is in the back of the head, you have to see what you're writing. The words are in the temporal lobe. And the top of the head is the motor cortex, which is the muscles. And the parietal lobe, which is kind of in between the two, coordinates all that. So just the simple act of handwriting, you're using your entire brain. And I'm trying, me and other graphologists are trying to get the grade schools to bring back learning the, Palmer method, the rapid writing as opposed to just printing, because it actually helps, retrain the brain. So those are 2 branches. And the 3rd branch is question documents, which is how I make a lot of my living. I look at forgery cases. Let's say a husband and a wife get divorced, and all of a sudden, one of them passes away, and then there's a discussion of who signed the will, and the children think that the ex-wife signed the husband's name, that kind of thing. So I have to determine whether or not it's the husband's handwriting or whether or not the wife signed it. So that's a lot of what forgery cases is a lot about. So that's, a lot of the history of it and the 3 major branches: personality, neurophysiology, and question documents.
You can see I have this cheesy grin on my face because as you're speaking, I just couldn't help but smile and think life is so cool. And this is, this is one of the biggest reasons why I'm so honored that you're coming onto the show today, because we sort of, a lot of us go through life sort of dead-end or not appreciating how many interesting, magical things there are, including this handwriting analysis. Maybe it's my backup career. I don't know. This is just so interesting. Wow. So let's dive into it. I've sent you 5 samples. You very graciously agreed to analyze them. As I said, Dr. Cipher does not know who these people are, though he will find out. And let's go. Do you have the photo, Sean? So let's start with sample number 1. What did you learn about this sample, about this individual? Let's go through some of the forms and methods here.
Okay, so we're looking at...
Yes, this one. Yep.
Yeah, I would compare it to, I guess it's the 3rd one.
Oh, interesting.
So you see they're both large handwritings.
Okay. Yes.
But the big difference is, you see the angles in the word sample.
Mm-hmm.
And my very sharp angles.
Mm-hmm.
As compared to, look at the word handwriting, the W is kind of rounded.
Yeah.
And the N is rounded. So that's the big difference. These are two dominant people who like the spotlight. If I had to guess, I'm guessing you're the top one. And that it's a warm writing, but someone who wants to, you know, who's outgoing and extroverted. And the bottom one is also outgoing and extroverted, but they're a lot sharper. They're a lot more of a tough cookie. So I would think that that person is much more apt to want to get their way no matter what, whereas the top person is more willing to compromise. And the top person, more there's a sense of a mothering instinct, you know, wanting to take care of people. They're, both of those writings are people writings. And when you get to the bottom two, they're much smaller.
Right.
So the top one of the bottom one, that you know, that where it says seven is the number before, there's a big spacing between the words. This is a bit of loneliness. And this is someone who is very interested in science. They're objective. They're shy. They're more introverted. And the bottom person is the genius of the group. This person is wants to do things very rapidly. They're an abstract thinker. Probably took advanced mathematics, that kind of thing, and is an abstract thinker. So those are some of the differences in, between all of those. So I think the top person is the warm-hearted one. I'm taking a guess that it's you. Next one is...
I'm sorry, you said the top person is the warm one, you said?
Warm-hearted, yes.
Warm-hearted, okay.
The next one is very sharp. So they're outgoing. They also have some warmth, but boy, they're a tough cookie. They want to get their way. But they're also open-minded. The third one is a bit of a, you know, a bookworm, someone who spends time in the library and is a bit introverted and some sense of loneliness. And the fourth one is this abstract, very rapid thinker with a lot of signs of real brilliance. And then I can do the next handwriting. I want to talk about the next handwriting later, but those are the four, those are the people I'm guessing you're working with. And that's some of my thoughts about them.
Very interesting. So let's go one by one. So the first one, you said that it's because the handwriting is big and
rounded.
And rounded. So what indicates that this person is warm?
The roundedness of it. It's round. It's sensual, round, and caring, as opposed to the second one, which is sharp. And that doesn't mean that person is not warm-hearted, but these angles show that this person's sharp. That's a sign of dominance. That's real toughness. This is a tough cookie.
Yep.
The word my has an openness. So this is someone who's open, very, very smart, and takes over.
So why does the my indicate an openness? What about the M and the Y or the spacing?
The M is like a U. It's called a garland. So it's an angle garland. It's an openness as opposed to being closed. So it's an open M, and that tells me that that person is open to new ideas. And if you look at the H in the word this, I don't know, can we see
yes,
the word
I
this?
Yes, I can. That's good. Yep.
Yeah, the that's ambition. You know, something is pushing this person up. You know, let me keep going and can keep driving.
The length of the H, you mean?
That it goes very high up. So this is a very dominant go-getter who takes charge and is the most dominant of the four handwritings.
And then the spacing out of the third one indicates that that individual is lonely.
There's some loneliness there. And the fact that it's It's very controlled, very clear. He's a clear thinker, someone who studied, maybe likes history, likes to go to the library, likes to read, more introverted. They're a study person. And the fourth person, this, to me, sign of real brilliance, is an abstract thinker, rapid thinking. There's also wide spacing, so there is some existential loneliness in there as well. The bottom two are not so much the people. The top two are more people persons. The bottom two are more cerebral.
So what indicates the abstract thinking? You said that the fourth one, the bottom one, was the genius of the group.
Yeah.
Arguably, that one is the worst handwriting sample.
Not from my point of view. From my point of view, this is a very high-level handwriting. Mm. It's you can read it. It's written very rapidly. Look at the word "what." How quickly that person wrote. It's highly simplified.
So it's the fact that this individual wrote it clearly, rapidly, but yet the words are still legible that indicates to you that it's the genius of the group.
Very rapid thinking. Yes.
Fascinating.
They got other things to do. I got to get this down and get on to the next thing. This is someone who's quick thinker, and it's abstract. It shows abstract. I think high math ability, but this wide spacing between words, which again is some sense of loneliness. This is a cerebral person.
Hmm. So I know that you answered this when I asked you the second question about the history of graphology, but can you explain again what the connection is between the brain and handwriting? So you're saying that the numbers 3 and 4 indicate a loneliness with the spacing. Some could argue, some would say, how can that possibly be indicated in handwriting? Just spacing, well, they just want to make sure that each word stands on its own and that it's legible. What's your response to that?
That's a great question. It's just an excellent question. Wide spacing between words is just a sign of loneliness. You want me to give you the neurological reason, and I'm not sure that I can do that right now. In general, big, large handwritings, which the first two, they're more people-oriented. The smaller handwritings are more cerebral. They're more, introverted, taking their time. They're not as people-oriented. But certainly the third one, certainly warm-hearted. This extra spacing between words, it's each word, it's the opposite. If you see a lot of words together, that person wants to be with people. If you see space, they need space. They're asking for, some separate space, that they need some space. So I can't quite totally relate it to the neurophysiology at this moment, but that's kind of what standard graphology.
So what's interesting about your analysis, Dr. Seifer, is that you did it in a comparative form. And you can see the way that I started, which, by the way, is totally fine, but my original question, I said, let's start with number one, and I sort of thought that you would do it individually. But what's fascinating is that you grouped the first two together and then the last two together, and you used the first two to compare to the last two, et cetera. So you did it in this comparative form. If I had just given you one of these samples alone without being able to compare it to others, would you have reached the same conclusions?
Well, it was clear to me that they all knew each other. And so I felt that from explaining it point of view, it's a lot easier to explain it that way. If I were just given the top handwriting, I would write a clear analysis just on the top handwriting. But also, I never do this. I want to know the age. I want to know even what the occupation would be, what handedness they are. The sex of the person. We're doing this for fun, but if someone's going to pay me, $500 or $1,000 to do the handwriting, I don't want to make it a mystery. I want to know as much as I can about the person because I'm trying to help the person. So you have that as well. I mean, I didn't deal with the eye dots too. The first person's got, I think all the dots, all the I's are dotted, which, is attention to detail. The second person's using all capital letters so they didn't have to deal with the I dots. The last person is also dotting the I's. So there's a lot of attention to detail here as well. But yes, to answer your question, if I was just given one handwriting, you would spend a lot of time. So you spend a few hours really looking at it, living with the handwriting and really getting a feel. But you want to know something about the person, their age, their sex, maybe what they did for a living.
Right.
But usually there's a reason why they want to learn more about themselves.
So I'm going to reveal the identities, though sort of. The first two I'm going to reveal the identities. The last two I'm not, because they've asked me not to. The first one, you're right, it's me. You know my age, you know my occupation. The second one, may I share? Okay, good. It's my dear producer, Sean. He is a, can I say your age? He's a 45-year-old technical producer, so now you know. And then the last two, I'll say that the third individual is a woman, the fourth is a man. One, three, and four know each other, but three and four do not know two. So I know Sean, my producer, but I know the last two, but those two do not know my producer. So it's interesting that you said that it was clear that from the samplings that we knew each other, because again, I did not tell Dr. Cipher any of this. I mean, you probably could have surmised that I would pick people, but one of the samples that we're going to get to in a moment, I don't know the person. So how were you able to tell that we knew each other?
Well, I just assumed it because they all wrote the same thing. And you only had a day or two to give me the handwriting.
I thought there was something in the handwriting analysis that maybe we had similar forms.
No, but if I had to guess, I would have guessed the second one was the producer, because that's a dominant, powerful handwriting.
Right. And you were spot on, I have to say, with three and four about their interests, their personalities. It's you really you got it spot on. So I'm not trying to be a narcissist. I'm just trying to use this as an opportunity to see what more we can glean now that you know that the first one was me, though of course you suspected it was me. You said that you like to know when you're analyzing the handwriting, the sex and the occupation of the person. So I guess now that it's confirmed that number one is me, what more, if anything, can you glean from the handwriting sample?
Well, one of the things I can glean is you are a heck of a poker player, because you didn't give an inch there when I said it was you. So I think you're a poker player. But what I suggested here, that's why I was talking about the eye dots. This is a large people person handwriting. You like people. You're warm hearted. It's a very large handwriting. You like to be in the spotlight. But the fact that all the eye dots are there to me tells me that the details are important to you. You don't want to leave these things to chance. It's a youthful handwriting. The bottom handwriting is, much more mature in that sense. You know what I mean? It's a person's like a PhD type person who's, in that other realm. But it's just, I just see a warm-hearted, clear thinker. The fact that it's very large, but it fits very well on the page. It's well organized. And that, again, there's attention to detail. It's important. So it's kind of opposites. You have a big, giant handwriting, but you're not forgetting the details. So you're covering both bases, I would say.
Feel free to answer this question honestly, though I've revealed that it's me. Do you see any pathologies in that handwriting, really with any of them?
Well, the top one is definitely a sign of paranoid schizophrenia. There's no doubt about it.
No, not schizophrenic?
No, you are. Paranoid schizophrenic is a classic example.
So you're saying I'm not?
No, you are. This is
a classic example. Oh, my God.
No, I'm teasing.
I'm teasing. I thought he was being serious. Totally, I'm looking at my bruises. Cut it out.
It's a wonderful handwriting. You have a wonderful handwriting. What can I say? You really do.
Oh my God. You should have felt my heart.
That's what I said.
Number two is the schizo one. Number two, Sean.
I didn't mean to throw you that kind of curve.
No, it's funny. It's so funny, actually. So in all seriousness, though, no pathologies there?
No, I don't. I see just a warm-hearted, caring person. Someone who likes the world, likes people.
Okay. Well, thank you. Good. So let's move on to this next sample. Do you recognize it?
Yes.
I had a feeling that he might recognize it. So it's Hitler's handwriting. I wanted to give four non-famous people, one extremely famous person, also four normal, nice people, and then one sadist, to put it lightly.
Is this the handwriting we're talking about?
Yes, that's Hitler's handwriting.
No, that's not Hitler.
That's not?
No, not even close.
Oh, really? Well, that was, according to the internet, Hitler's handwriting.
Really?
No. Oh, so you said you recognized it. It's who?
Clifford Irving, the guy at the top. Mm. It says, you are the author of my autobiography, and it's signed Howard Hughes. This is a very famous forgery that Clifford Irving did of Howard Hughes' handwriting. Howard Hughes was a billionaire who kind of disappeared from the world. No one had seen him in 10 years. And Clifford Irving said that Howard Hughes had given me the right to write his autobiography, and he got $350,000 advance from McGraw-Hill in the 1970s. That's still a lot of money today, but $350,000 40 years ago is like getting, you know, it's $10 million advance. I mean, he got a lot of money. And then Howard Hughes called up McGraw-Hill and said, that's not me, that's not my handwriting. What Howard Hughes, what Clifford Irving had done was he had taken a known sample of Howard Hughes' handwriting, which had appeared in Life magazine, and used that as the model. So you've got here a kind of a combination. It's kind of a warm handwriting. There's a lot of curves and warmth to it, but it's also broken apart. And that's how Howard Hughes would write. Like if you see the word agreed at the bottom.
Yes.
A-G-R. Well, why isn't the G moving into the R? And why isn't the R connected to the E? Howard Hughes really was disconnected. The word publisher, it's all, you know, split apart. The S and then the H. So Hughes would write like that, but Hughes' handwriting was much more brittle. Mm. Very funny story about this. You had a picture of my book that you showed. I wanted to get the rights to use Clifford Irving's handwriting, so I wrote to Clifford Irving and asked if I could use his handwriting in the book. And he wrote back and he said yes. So my sister and brother-in-law came up one day and we were talking about Clifford Irving because there's a famous movie with Richard Gere where he plays Clifford Irving in this scam that he does. And they said, it's too bad he's dead. I said, he's not dead. They said, yes, he is. And they showed me Wikipedia. So he's dead. I said, he's not dead. I just got a letter from him yesterday. And I went down, picked out
That's
the
amazing.
Letter, showed it to him from yesterday. and the story here, why this is so important, is we believe the internet. The internet says a guy isn't here, and yet I knew that he was still on the planet because I had just gotten a letter from him. So it's really the problem of, how do you verify if something is true or not? So they were surprised, and we still laugh about that story because, you know, I had the perfect proof that he really was, that the Wikipedia page was totally wrong. And so I don't know how that ended up being Hitler's handwriting, but that's not even close to Hitler's handwriting. Hitler has a handwriting that falls off, it shows suicidal tendencies, and he built a country. You know, all these people that are anti-Semites and pro-Hitler. Hitler killed millions and millions of his own people by not fleeing from Russia when got to be 20 and 30 below zero. And his generals were saying, we got to pull out of Russia. He said, no, we got to stay and we got to fight. And, something like 3 or 4 million German soldiers froze to death because of Hitler's stupidity. So anybody who, follows his think he's a great guy, when you really look at him, he was suicidal and he took down not only himself, but he took down his own country and ruined that country for the years that he was in charge.
Well, I'm really glad that this mistake happened because I learned something, and it really does show that you can't trust the internet. That's not what I learned. I learned about Clifford Irving and how you can tell if someone's alive. So we're going to put up a photo of Hitler's handwriting. So when you say that the letters fall off, is it the way that they're slanted? Is it the way that perhaps the letters don't Hitler didn't close his letters? What is it about the handwriting specifically that indicates
the handwriting? it kind of tumbles down.
Oh.
So instead of going straight, it falls off like a cliff. And that's, in his case, it's suicidal. He had a self-destructive personality. And he took the whole country down with him, you know, in that. So that's what you'll see in the handwriting that you'll show.
So put it up. If someone's handwriting leans more right or leans more left, what does that indicate generally?
In general, we're taught to lean to the right. And leaning to the right is leaning towards people. So most people have a slightly right slant, which is warm-hearted. Most people, you know, you get on a bus, you say hello to people. Most people like other people. But it gets complicated because let's say you have a person with a left slant. Now, if they're a lefty, actually it's more comfortable sometimes for lefties to slant to the left. So there's a difference if a lefty slants to the left as opposed to a righty slanting to the left. So let's say if a righty slants to the left and they're taught to slant to the right, there's a rebellion of some type. So I would, you know, look at it this way. There's all possibilities. Why is this person rebelling? Are they mad at their parents, or they just like to, you know, go left when other people go right? What's the reason for the rebellion? Some rebellions are good and some rebellions are antagonistic, you know, like a negative personality. So the left slant might have a positive connotation or a negative connotation. It really depends on other factors. It's very complicated. Graphology is very, very complicated, very fascinating. I've been doing it for, you know, a long, long time, and you never stop learning. You just never stop learning.
So a final question I have for you about this, and then I want to ask you a little bit about Nikola Tesla and ozone therapy before this interview has to end. But when I was submitting my handwriting sample, I noticed I actually wrote one the first time and my ink smudged. So then I decided to write it a second time to provide it to you with more to make it more legible. And I noticed there wasn't a huge difference between the first and the second, but there were some differences. For instance, in the way that I sort of drew letters, you could still tell both of them were clearly me, but there were some differences. And also, one of the number four who submitted, or number three, excuse me, who submitted their handwriting, she wrote it one time, and then I thought that her sample, what she actually wrote, like the content of what she wrote, I thought revealed something about her personality. So then I asked her to write a separate second sample where she just said the number after seven is eight, something neutral so you couldn't get any sense of her personality. But I even noticed with her, her handwriting was a bit different. So my question for you is, if I had submitted my first sample that didn't smudge, or if she had submitted her first sample, would you have been able to draw the same conclusions?
You know, as you're talking, I have to laugh a little bit. When I got my license renewed, there was a line in there. I'm not making this up. It said you could be inducted into the Army. Okay, sign here. And it was for the signature for the license. And I read that, and I'm going, I could be inducted into the Army. And my handwriting just fell apart. And I said to the lady, I said, can I redo it? She said, no, it's too late. It's now in the computer. So now if you look at my license, I got this really horrible signature because of that sentence. Our emotions play a big role in this, depending on the situation. And certain words sometimes, let's say a person, you know, just had a fight with their father. And so maybe the capital F, you know, will be squinched, and another day it wouldn't be. But the word father subconsciously would cause, you know, that to be influenced. So overall, it shouldn't make a difference overall. But, you know, handwriting's alive, and it definitely can reflect the moment. And you get keys sometimes when certain words, you know, show up in unusual fashion. That is kind of the way I'm saying it. The size of words, too. Like, you know, when you're doing a lot of handwritings, for instance, I'll do, you know, writing and a gal will come in and let's say her name, you know, Susie Smith, and the S for Susie is giant and the S for Smith is small and she's got a ring on, so you know she's married. And I say, you know, well, you seem to really want to, you know, express yourself, you know, beyond your marriage. And she says, how do you know that? Well, I could see that she was married. And she's emphasized Susie as opposed to Smith. But let's say you're a Kennedy, you know, Susan Kennedy, you know, you're one of the Kennedys. Well, the K might be giant because you're so proud of being a Kennedy, and the S could be smaller. So it might be just, You see what I mean? That there's the influence of that kind of thing will influence the size of the capital letters.
That is fascinating, truly. I'm going to order your book on handwriting analysis and become a savant and an expert in it. You've really motivated me.
I think you have talent. I think you have really, from the questions you've asked, I think you would find it fascinating.
Well, backup career, everyone. You know, you saw it here. You know what it is. I hate to be so short with these next questions because you've written so extensively about both subjects. For the sake of time, and I will have you on again if you're willing to come on to discuss these subjects more in depth. But for the sake of time, I'd like to ask you, what is one thing that we should know about Nikola Tesla? And what is one thing that we should know about ozone therapy? You can see here in the background of Dr. Seifer's screen, he has written books on these subjects. So if you could impart, I guess, two pieces of wisdom about those respective subjects, what would they be?
Okay, before I do, I just want to quickly say that Tesla invented an ozone generator. That's how I learned about ozone therapy. I would never have known about ozone therapy if I hadn't been studying Tesla. And Tesla was, selling ozone generators at the turn of the century because they have healing properties. What's most important about Tesla is that he's a primary inventor. He invented fluorescent lighting. And we all know what it was like in the old Edison bulbs. You'd burn your hands whenever you touched the bulb because it was wasting so much in heat. He said, why waste it in heat? Why not just produce light? Tesla also invented what became the hydroelectric power system, the entire power grid. Is still based on Tesla's invention. And part of that is the induction motor, which is the motor that runs the world. Tesla calculated how many man hours he saved on the planet with the invention of his motor. What he felt was that if machines could do the work, then humans could go back to school and the intelligence of the species would increase at geometric rates. And Tesla's also the inventor of wireless communication and also cell phone technology, the ability to create an unlimited number of wireless channels. He's a true genius in every sense of the word. And because he invented an ozone generator in 1896 and patented it, I learned about ozone therapy when I went to a conference in 1984 where I was speaking at in Colorado Springs. And I saw Dr. George Freebot speak. And he said a man was dying of cancer. His body was riddled with tumors. This was 1984. And he said, as a last resort, I gave him ozone therapy, which is an injection into the arm of 97% pure oxygen and 3% ozone. And the person, he said, was healed. The tumors were shed and he was healed. Now that was 35 years ago. I forgot about it, basically. I stuck it in the first Tesla book I wrote, but I only came up with it again when the COVID pandemic started, and I found a number of ozone therapists, medical doctors who co-wrote this book with me, Dr. Robert Rowan, Dr. Howard Robbins, Dr. Gerard Sonnen, and Dr. Perez. And these four medical doctors are ozone therapists. Three of them, Robbins, Rowan, and Perez, have all successfully disabled the COVID virus in equivalent to about 200 people, but the federal government, the FDA, has some writings which make it very hard for ozone therapists to practice. So I've been really fighting to try and get the FDA Title 21, which said ozone's a toxic gas with no medical application, to rescind that federal regulation because it's just wrong. And I feel strongly that if they had not denigrated ozone therapists, we would not have had this horrible, horrible pandemic. If we had had an ozone therapist in every one of these old age homes, these people would have been cured. That's what this book is really all about. It's a very unbelievable story. But I learned all of this because of Tesla. So in general, in a positive way, ozone therapy just boosts the immune system. In 2001, Paul Wentworth, you can Google him, Wentworth, discovered that our own antibodies manufacture ozone. So it's just a way to enhance what our own immune system is already doing. And those are the two things about each of these subjects based upon your question.
And ozone therapy is, I heard on a recent interview you said that it's toxic to inhale ozone. So what are you referring to when you say ozone therapy, just in, you know, pumping ozone into cars or on surfaces? Is that what you're referring to?
Well, ozone is a disinfectant. So, right. And hospitals use it. The Olympic teams use it to disinfect swimming pools. Swimming pools now are disinfected with ozone. So there's a danger to it. There's no doubt about it. But the medical doctors know about the danger. So what ozone therapy is, it's mostly oxygen, pure oxygen. It's 97% pure oxygen, just 3% ozone. And that is introduced into the bloodstream. And since our own body is producing ozone anyway, Wentworth is the guy who discovered this. I think he deserves a Nobel Prize for the discovery. We're just enhancing what our own immune system is doing. One of the things I learned is I studied, you know, the history of the immune system. And one, I have these books on the immune system. One book I read said, if you got a splinter, and if we didn't have a powerful immune system, you'd be dead in 2 or 3 days because the bacteria would multiply so rapidly. We're producing, and yet it's not believable, we are producing 100,000 white blood cells, antibody cells, a second. We're producing 2 million red blood cells a second. Now, you have to look back. I have chills telling you this. You have to look back in awe and say, wow, the immune system is very, very smart. So over hundreds of millions of years, the immune system learned how to protect all animals, including humans. And one of the ways it did it was it changed oxygen, which is O2, into ozone, which is O3. So we produce ozone in our antibodies. They never tell you how the vaccines work. You say you need a vaccine and you'll be cured. The vaccine doesn't cure you. What the vaccine does is it gives the body a head start. So when you breathe in COVID, the body has already recognized that's that shape. And so you're ahead of the game. And now you produce an antibody, and the antibody kills the COVID virus. But they never tell you how the antibody kills the COVID virus. I just did. Our antibodies manufacture ozone, they manufacture hydrogen peroxide, and they manufacture certain enzymes that disable and kill the viruses. So all ozone therapy is enhancing that process. Mm-hmm. And the difference between vaccines and ozone therapy, you can only give a vaccine to a healthy person. If a person has COVID, there's no point in giving them the vaccine. So if they're in the ICUs, you can't give them vaccines. But you can go in with ozone therapy. And the clinical studies there are two that I talk about in the book, they successfully disabled the COVID virus in the two clinical studies using ozone therapy. But there's been a tremendous resistance. I've been working very hard. I just got letters from the Prime Minister of England and from Justin Trudeau, the Prime Minister of Canada, thanking me for the book. And they're not signed by the two prime ministers, they're signed by their aides, but thanking me with the entire title of the book. And one senator, Sheldon Whitehouse, has thanked me for the book. We have to change the FDA regulation. It's just plain dumb to block a known therapy that's simply enhancing what our own immune system is already doing.
I lied when I said this was my final question because my producers asked me one to relay to you in my ear, and I think it's really worth it. Just quickly going back to the handwriting. With the advent of computers and with the popularity of computers and typing, A, has that changed and influenced handwriting? And B, is handwriting at risk of going away or being less reliable source to analyze one's personality and pathologies?
I'm going to ask you a question. Do you ever play an instrument?
I played a piano when I was younger, and unfortunately, I quit.
Okay, but you did learn how to play a piano.
Yes.
It took talent. You had to practice, and you've actually retrained your brain.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever throw a frisbee?
Yes.
It took a while, though, to learn how to do that, right?
Yes.
Handwriting is a talent. It's different than printing, and it's this cursive handwriting. And it's very important that we bring back handwriting to say as a talent, just as learning a musical instrument or learning how to throw a frisbee. It retrains the brain in a very positive way. And so I agree with you that with all the punching with the thumbs and all this stuff, handwriting may, you know, fall more out of favor, but the schools are helping move it out of favor when they shouldn't. It's just like learning a musical instrument or learning how to throw a frisbee or learning how to play chess or learning anything else. It's a talent that different people developed over time as the best way to write rapidly. The last handwriting that we saw, that person knows the cursive handwriting, and he learned a very rapid way of writing. Someone who prints can never do that. In fact, a lot of the kids growing up today can't read their parents' handwritings because it's in cursive. So I think you're right. We run the risk of losing it, but it's a real talent that we should not lose. And I think kids enjoy. When I taught for 40 years, I would scribble my stuff on the blackboard, and I think they got a kick out of, you know, trying to figure out what the heck I was writing, and saw that as you're thinking, you're writing at the same time, and they're taking notes too. So I think it's important to keep handwriting as an important talent. One other thing about it is, why do we evolve to the top of the food chain? You know, why are humans at the very top? And the reason is language. We have a language center. We're able to coordinate troop movements and whatever. That's how we beat the Neanderthal man. Neanderthal actually had a larger brain than Cro-Magnon man, but they didn't have as good a voice box. They didn't have the ability to speak as well. Handwriting is written speech, so it's more advanced than talking, in a sense. And so it's a more advanced form which enabled humans to evolve. And to somehow strip us away from that is just dumb. It just doesn't make sense. So I think I'm really, you know, hoping that the schools will listen and that we'll bring back the teaching of cursive. Many schools still teach cursive, but there's a whole bunch of schools that no longer teach it because they say we're all using computers now. Well, that's not the case. In fact, if you're in a courtroom or if you're in, you know, a board meeting, a lot of times it's not right to be typing out or whatever. Handwriting is much more silent, and it's a good way, and it's more creative too. You know, when you type, every letter is the exact same. Mm-hmm. There's a sameness to it. Whereas writing is more alive. You mentioned redoing something, and you probably know because I can see you like to write, that sometimes writing it, that process of writing it down as opposed to typing, there's something, it's like dreaming and stuff. There's something about that that gets you more in touch with your creative processes. So I would, you know, make a strong appeal that teach your kids the Palmer method. You know, there are a lot of books that you can get online as to how to learn it. But see it as a talent, you know, like the other talents that I mentioned.
I think what you just said about students looking at their teacher's handwriting and sort of getting them thinking, that's such a valuable point. I remember seeing my teachers write notes on the board and going, sort of thinking, oh, why do they write that way? That must be a certain pathology or part of their personality that they have. It makes you contemplate life. And again, the thesis statement of this whole interview is that life is very cool. Thank you very much for exposing us to that. You can find out more about Dr. Seifer at Mark, M-A-R-C, Seifer, Seifer.com. Thank you again for your time.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And thank you for clarifying that I don't have schizophrenia. Thanks so much for joining us today. And remember that each of our thoughts, choices, and actions shape who we are. So let's think clearly. Choose wisely and act with principle and determination. See you soon. Take care.
Three-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.